She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today is made possible due to the generous support of the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. We thank them for their support of Mrs. Green's World mission. We truly do, and for their vision and for all they do to make our community and our world a better place. So this is the show that was meant to happen, and I can't help but laugh. We had many glitches before we went on air, but my guest today got it. He's a friend. He's not a stranger to the Mrs. Green's World Network or to me. Please join me in welcoming David Orr. He is a Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Senior Advisor to the President of Oberlin College. And throughout the show, we'll learn a lot more about David. So, David, this is a show about resilience and tenacity. Agreed?
It sure is.
There were glitches in the matrix, a computer problem, a connection problem, but we made it happen. And it's an important show. I'm so glad you stayed with me. And let's do this thing, as they say. So,
it sounds good.
Yeah, you've been on the show before. As I said to you, we have thousands more listeners now from all over the country. And your baby, you had a vision, and it was called the Oberlin Project. And you wanted to address the full spectrum of sustainability, an all-encompassing joint venture that involved the town, the college, the community, everything, all the pieces, all the moving parts. Tell us about your vision. Now it's all about you for the rest of the show, my friend.
Well, first of all, thank you. It's nice to be back here. The Oberlin Project is the culmination of lots of different things, and it is many different visions rolled into one. The central idea, as you put it, is that sustainability, if it's going to be full spectrum sustainability across the range of many different issues, has to include issues of social justice and food and employment and energy and transportation and governance and all of these things together. So 8 or 9 years ago, several of us had a vision of making Oberlin, a little town of maybe 10,000 people when the college students are here, located in the center of the American Rust Belt around the western shores of Lake Erie, into a model of sustainability that would include lots of those components. And we singled out a few in particular. But as background, Oberlin is a town that was built around the college. Oberlin was the first American college to accept African Americans and women and graduate them, so that's part of our DNA over the life of the institution. It has a brilliant conservatory of music. It turns out more kids who go on for PhDs in the sciences than any other small liberal arts college in the country. I chaired the environmental studies program here for years. My work now is mostly working for the president and as now chairman of the board of the Oberlin Project. Specifically, the goals for the project were the following. We wanted to make the city and the college both carbon neutral.
Okay.
And do that in a way that built a brand new economy powered by sunshine and efficiency and so forth. We secondly wanted to build a food system or rebuild a food system that would supply maybe up to 70% of our food from local farmers. Thirdly, we wanted to do all of this as an educational venture. And so the idea of engaging students from college and high school and so forth became an early part of the project. And then there are lots of other things that have to happen. We have to change the way we manage money. and investment and spending and the rules by which institutions work. So it had a lot of moving parts to it. When we started, there were organizations here in the city and around the region that did some of those things to one degree or another. I think the uniqueness of the Urban Project is to put these collectively together into a system where the parts reinforce the whole. And that's a lot easier to say than to do.
Yeah. Like everybody should press pause now and say, yeah, a lot easier said than done. Lots of moving parts. Whoa.
Well, we're inventing a different way, and I think to go back into Western history, we've made a lot of mistakes. We got off on the wrong road. And you pull out names like Descartes and Bacon and Galileo or Henry Ford or whatever.
Yes.
You start to whoop up on them because they weren't asking the kind of questions, what if and what then?
Right.
And what connected to what? And so we built an automobile-intensive society that paved over an area, I'm told, roughly the size of the state of Kentucky in the United States and probably larger by now. That tied our foreign policy to the Middle East, a highly unstable region, dictated our military policy around the world to protect oil supply lines, also became the largest source of pollution and climate change gases and so forth. But no one thought of that when Henry Ford began to mass-produce Model T. It was just, boy, it's a great thing. You know, you were free and liberated. But the what-if questions are the ones that seem to come back and bite us in the tail. So the Urban Project is an attempt to take that word systems, which is an abstraction, and sustainability, which is an abstraction, and give it heart and meaning. And since we are mostly visual creatures, we have to make these things part of the default thing, what we see, touch, feel, experience. But we privilege eyesight. And so seeing sustainability, seeing solar collectors and windmills and local farms and so forth becomes really important part of this. To that end, we collectively here in town have spent about maybe $106 million so far.
Wow.
We deployed a 11-acre solar array, remodeled several buildings, including a very famous building, the Allen Art Museum, which is one of the premier art museums in higher education. Three former students at Oberlin built a $17 million mixed housing complex in the heart of the downtown. We just opened a new hotel and conference center powered by an off-site solar array. And it probably is another $40 or $50 million to spend. But one of the things that we did do that was, I think, important for everybody listening is when you begin to think about sustainability, the question comes back, what are your assets and liabilities in your own community? In our case, in Oberlin, we had a great little college, one of the real premier institutions of higher education, very distinctive and with a very serious commitment to sustainability and to social justice. We also have a great conservatory of music, a great performing arts program, and so the possibility formed early that we would join these in a larger dialogue about sustainability. And so it's not just like a Presbyterian finger-wagging lecture on, you know, did you eat your tofu today or whatever. But in that case, sustainability can become part of a larger celebration of life.
Right.
And we mix the arts and performance, and the arts in all their forms, and performance and music, and, oh, by the way, the food's grown locally, and the hotel is 100% solar powered. So can you begin to put together assets in ways that are partly a celebration of where we are, a celebration of life and fecundity and beauty and so forth? So sustainability isn't just this, oh my God, here they come again, they're going to talk about sustainability kind of thing. So that's the heart of the effort. We're hoping at some point to take this to scale, and by that I mean begin to affect other cities and regions. If we don't take it to scale and do that very quickly, the human prospect becomes a good bit darker. The good news for me is that there are lots of things like the Oberlin Project, transition towns and work all over the world, where people are taking their future into their own hands and beginning to change their towns and cities and regions and so forth. And so a good bit of what we're proposing to do is really surfing an already very large and rapidly moving wave.
And so people are watching. So go ahead, because my questions abound.
Say that again, please.
I just want to press pause in your thought process for a minute, because you mentioned that there were things that you learned early on and mistakes you made, which is how we truly do learn. What were some of those mistakes, and what you would, in building a model that can be replicated in other communities, what are some of the things that you would help others to learn and maybe shorten the learning curve?
Oh, my. So we have 4 or 5 hours, right?
Well, David, you and I should do a marathon show someday. And, you know, instead of like Evenings with Maury, Tuesdays with Maury, or whatever that is, it should be, you know, David and Gina just going on and on. Because I have so many questions. It's like, I just want to hear you go on.
Well, on the mistake side, I think that one of the issues, I don't know if it's a mistake or not, there are different strategies about how you engage people in the community. And whether you do this as a top-down or bottom-up or some combination of in between. And I don't think I'd describe it as a mistake, but we began by first developing a vision. And only I drafted the initial paper, and a few other people got on it, and our board, which is a pretty good cross-section of the city, bought into it. But we didn't do a kind of community-wide charrette. And years ago, I was involved with David Crockett a little bit and lots of other brilliant people in developing a green plan for Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has been largely successful. And that plan began with leadership by the city council, David Crockett in particular, a local foundation, the Lyndhurst Foundation, put money into it, and they began to develop a series of community-wide charrettes or planning meetings, which opened the doors to everybody. They had a lot of brilliant people come in as speakers, and Amory Lovins and John Todd and Bill McDonough, and lots of folks came through there. I mean, learned the mayor of Curitiba in Brazil. But it became a much wider dialogue, and the result was, I think, a significant buy-in by the community. In our case, we adopted a plan that said the Oberlin Project would be a temporary catalytic organization, maybe with a life of 9 or 10 years.
Right.
And at the end of that time, we go away without going away. Our functions in housing, education, food, policy, and so forth would continue, but as part of either for-profit organizations, local businesses such as a food hub, or nonprofit organizations, service organizations, or existing organizations like the city and the college. And so the goal was to change the default setting of those existing institutions, introduce something new by starting businesses, particularly in energy, housing, and food. But there are lots of different strategies, and I think there is no perfect strategy. I think for listeners interested in working in their own community, there are many different models. We're only one. The transition town movement that grew out of Totnes, England, is another very vibrant model. There are now cities combined into carbon neutral cities network that is tapping into global interests, and they were a considerable presence at the COP21 meeting in Paris. So there are lots of ways to think about this, and lots of ways to engage with local people. My advice would be to calibrate the strategy as much as possible with the particularities of the place.
Right.
Every
right.
place has its distinctive culture, history, people, assets, liabilities, and so forth. But in any case, I think the numbers tell us that we have to work with a real sense of urgency. The time
there's
is not
that.
A good
time. Yes.
And, well, you know, to change the subject just a little bit, I think the conversation about sustainability at one end is euphoric. It's very exciting to see the cost of solar collectors drop dramatically and their adoption rate go up well into the double digits and wind power expanding and all the numbers at that level look really good, very exciting. If we had 100 years to make the transition, I would be wildly optimistic and probably just up and go bowling.
Now there's a visual.
that's an ugly visual too, by the way. The other bookend of this debate is looking at the remorseless working of big numbers that are mostly the biogeochemical systems of Earth. Oceans are acidifying, sea levels are rising because of melting ice. The fire in the terribly ironic fire up in Alberta that
is
probably caused by warming, early warming, and climate change is now threatening the tar sands of all,
of all things. Yeah.
I mean, who said God didn't have a sense of humor? I mean, but this is kind of the range of opinions. And you can look at the 400 parts per million that is now the standard reference point, and Mauna Loa has had readings as high as, I think, 410 or 11 parts per million CO2. And so the bad news continues to flow in at one side, and the good news about technological capacity on the other. Somewhere in between those, maybe closer to the bad news side of the spectrum, is the issues that Bernie Sanders has raised, and the French economist Thomas Piketty and George Stiglitz, the American economist, and lots of other people about inequality. So Oxfam did a report a year ago that showed that if you put 62 people in a room, 60 of the wealthiest people on the planet in a room, they have more net wealth than the bottom 3.7 billion people. And the same is true in the United States, and we're now suffering through a bloat of billionaires that have working hard to corrupt American politics and buying legislation and or legislators and so forth. So that's not unrelated to our prospects here. You can easily envision, I'm getting off course here, but you can easily envision.
You know, you're really not. That's what I think is so interesting. It's really part of the bigger conversation and part of your vision and part of the urgency. So I'm following you, you're not off course. It's the really big issue of what are we doing and why aren't we in more of an urgent hurry?
Well, let me toss one more thing into that, and it's just the election. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have both tapped into a very large vein of discontent. And I don't know, there are many things that are feeding that. Racism, I think, is certainly part of it on one side. But on all sides, it's the disappearing opportunity. It's an economy that has been very heavily financialized. America used to make things, and manufacturing is a big part of it, and lots of people were on farms growing things. And now we've become a very different nation with a very different economy, whatever one's opinion about that. The way it's happened has engendered an awful lot of very deep-seated anger, and it expresses itself differently. And the bad part for me is that humans are, you know, we're not so much rational as we are very good rationalizers.
Right. And, I don't know why I keep laughing. It's like, yes, I need to, like, get it out. It's so true. Oh, my gosh, David.
But the
let's make it better.
What happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s isn't necessarily predictive of anything in the United States, but it's a warning that things, you know, this veneer of civilization can be pretty thin, and when times get hard, we turn on each other. And minorities of whatever the minority is can be pretty brutalized. So the issue about equity and justice and equal distribution is not a trivial part of the transition to sustainability. If it is not part of that transition to sustainability, it becomes a lot easier to envision a sustainable, efficient, solar-powered fascist society.
Right. Okay, we have to take a quick break. Quick break. Right. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Everybody stay here with me. More from David Orr, the Oberlin Project, and Scaling Equitable Climate Policy. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. And we're inviting you, all of our listeners today, to think about what I believe to be the most important issue facing every citizen of the planet, and that is about climate change. How do we scale equitable climate policy? How do we put the urgency in the minds of every person walking the planet? And our guest today is David Orr. I did mention that he's a Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics. He is senior advisor to the president of Oberlin College. He is the one that had the vision for the Oberlin Project, which we have been talking about. And I just want to mention a little bit more about David, who doesn't really care if I mention this, but I care. He's the recipient of 6 honorary degrees and other awards, including the Millennium Leadership Award from Global Green, the Bioneers Award, the National Wildlife Federation Leadership Award, a Lyndhurst Prize acknowledging a persons of excellence, of exceptional moral character, vision, and energy. And trust me when I say what we have as our guest today is a thought leader, and he is completely dedicated to the preservation of this great planet. He still remains passionate about it, incredibly passionate after all these years. And David, I just want to add a comment to your, you know, social justice and environmental justice issues. I interviewed Joaquin Ruiz, who I believe you know from the College of Science at the University of Arizona last week. And one of the things he said, which puts things so simply, is that why it becomes such a social justice and environmental justice issue is that, and this is just how he said it, he goes, if you're rich or of means and your shoreline is disappearing, you just move. If there's no water, you just find a place and pick up and go to a place where you can. Millions of people don't have that option. They have to stay where they are. They're already marginalized communities. So go on with that thread, because it's one of the ones that, you know, kind of takes my focus a lot.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And the myth somehow that people in the West and affluent societies, particularly the United States, will be immune to the worst part of climate change is just that. It is a myth.
It's nuts.
We already are being impacted in many ways by bigger storms and rising sea levels on both coasts, changing ecologies, the drying out of the Midwest. And so there's nobody that really understands the science that can run the film historically fast forward to say the year 2040 or 2050 or 2060 and be very happy about what they see. This is a really, it's a crisis like no other. We're very good if you can put a face on a threat. So we were phenomenal if we could put Adolf Hitler's face or Osama right. bin Laden's face yeah. on a threat, yeah. and that we can then attach all our anxieties and fears and dislikes to that person and that face. But in this case, as Walt Kelly in his very famous Pogo cartoon decades ago said, we've met the enemy and he is us.
Yes, yes, yes.
And everybody listening, and I certainly do, have a carbon footprint. We're all implicated in this system. And so, but then looking ahead just a moment, the water shortages that are very likely to hit in the Midwest and Deep South part of the country, and also the Southwest, mean that there will be climate refugees in the United States also.
I mean, climate refugees, nobody uses that term. In the United States, that is what's going to happen. And, you know, David, you didn't even mention the fire that's burning in the Northwest, in California. I mean, that fire is just unreal. It's hitting us on our own shores, is your point.
Well, it is. And here in the Great Lakes region, we're 14 miles south of Lake Erie. We still have, and probably will continue to have for a long time, abundant water supplies. They will change. And Lake Erie, for example, is getting warmer, and it may shrink in size or may grow in size. No one knows for sure, but it will not be unaffected by rising temperatures, increasing heat,
right,
and evapotranspiration and big storms and so forth. But people in Texas and in the Mid-South region and Southwest don't have that option. They're drawing down what water supplies they had in a warmer, hotter world. Many people are going to have to simply pack up and go.
And Houston, look what's happening in Houston. It gets off the news and something else takes its place, but the flooding there has been devastating to thousands of people.
Well, also in all coastal cities, Miami not the least of it, but all those cities along the Gulf Crescent and up the Atlantic seaboard, starting at Miami, are threatened by rising seas. And the estimates of how much sea level rise will be by the year 2050 or 2100 have continued to grow. The estimates themselves are escalating upward. But I think we'd be lucky by the end of the century to have no more than a 2-meter sea level rise. Some estimates were higher, some a bit lower, but I think we'd be lucky to escape with only a 2-meter sea level rise. But then it continues to rise thereafter. And seas rise for two reasons. One is simply as water gets hotter, it expands. Same thing you have in a tea kettle. And the other is that ice is melting. Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet in particular are shedding huge amounts of ice into the oceans, and so seas will continue to rise far into the future. But that means that people will be moving, and they'll have to escape places where there's chronic flooding and rising sea levels, but also places where the other extreme, water is scarce, it is too hot to live, and so forth.
So
people will be moving.
I want to ask you a question because it's so relevant to this people moving. Your vision in 2007, oh so long ago, and it probably started before that, that's when it launched, of creating a climate positive city, okay, where you addressed energy efficiency, reducing carbon emissions, improving the economy. How does what you have done and what you have accomplished so far position Oberlin, or does it, as a much stronger and more resilient community because of the things you've done, which is what the model was about in the first place? How will it impact Oberlin versus another city that hasn't put all of the energy, effort, time, money, and community engagement? What does that look like for you as a model?
Well, I think that we're a model in progress. We're not the model for anybody.
Right,
every
right.
city and region can be their own. But what this amounts to is something that people at the Pentagon in particular are coming to understand very well and have put out a series of reports and documents that describe the importance of this word resilience. And sustainability and resilience are related terms, but resilience in the words of a Marine Corps friend of mine is the capacity to take a gut punch and come back swinging. More formally and less prosaically, it is the capacity of a community or a region or even an entire nation
right.
to withstand disturbances and keep its core functions in operation. And so what we're trying to do here is to, for example, rebuild our local food system.
Right.
And
food
there are
security.
Two reasons. Yeah, that's right. There are two reasons for doing this. One of those is that we can't continue to import food at a volume we need at a price we could afford from California. California is drying out. And the export food market, as Stephen Hsu, the former Secretary of Energy, pointed out a few years ago, the export food market of California is coming into its final phase. And so you just can't move heavy things a long distance. First, in California, you won't be able to grow things. The fossil energy necessary to move truckloads or train loads of food from California in the west, southwest to New England and New York and so forth, and Oberlin, Ohio, you just can't do it. And the other reason to begin to rethink the food system is that's where the market's going. People are preferring to eat locally.
Right.
Locally grown foods, it's
right.
more nutritious, it's better, you employ local people, and you know, to have your farms close to your community is a resilient strategy in a potentially food insecure world. But the same is true with renewable energy. And so energy efficiency is simply limiting how much energy you have to use in whatever form, and then making the switch to renewable energy in its various forms of biomass, solar, and wind. But there's every reason of economics and of market trends to move in this direction. And then you begin to understand, as has been said by a number of Pentagon officials, that security of this country doesn't start at our shores and borders and work outward. It starts at our shores and borders also and works inward. And we are being hacked as a nation continually. There are lots of people around the world that would love to take down the U.S. electric grid or parts of it.
Right.
They would love to disrupt the U.S. food system. And you take out a couple of bridges on the Mississippi, and you've taken a big step to at least a temporary disruption of American food systems. So this word resilience ought to be part of the national dialogue. It isn't making America great again, I think, without trying to say too much about politics here, but I'm not sure when that was that we were great. We were great for some people under some conditions, but not so great for lots of others. And so the record is always spotty, but what we ought to be aiming toward is not something in the past that probably never existed, but something in the future that has to do with resilience and sustainability and our capacity to not only survive, but thrive through the traumas that one can expect that lie ahead.
Of which there are many. Of which there are many. So when you start talking about the Oberlin Project, and I know you have gone all over the world many times, it started in 2007. What are some of the things, you know, we're going to not finish this before we have another quick break, but what are some of the major things that really did work? How are you doing in terms of reducing your greenhouse gas emissions? Are you there at the 50% mark? We're at 2016.
We've eliminated in the city electric system, have eliminated somewhere around 87 to 89% of the carbon emissions in the city electric system. We've just opened a hotel and conference center that is powered from a portion of an 11-acre solar array that's off-site. It's about a quarter of a mile on a straight line away. That hotel is legitimately 100% solar-powered. That doesn't mean we're storing power on-site. At nighttime,
right.
We are drawing power from the grid. Daytime,
right.
We're getting a lot of power back into the grid. We have rebuilt a good bit of the downtown economy. The we in this case is all of the groups that comprise the kind of the Oberlin Alliance, the city, the college, a group of former students, sustainable development associates. There are lots of people involved in this, but the vision is a composite vision. It includes sustainable agriculture, and that takes you back to lots of heroes, Michael Pollan and Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson,
right.
And Rich Kirschman and Gene Logsdon, and lots of good people that worked on that movement for years. We're trying to take those ideas that have appeared in books and so forth and begin to build that into the local economy here as a viable source, not of nutrition only, but also of jobs and community pride and better health.
I want to ask you this. I really want to ask you this because it's such an important part of the conversation, David. How does all of this, your underpinning for this is truly jobs are created. There are jobs in agriculture. From what I read, you have a year-round farmer's market, which in Ohio, I'd love to know how you pull that off because it's not always warm in Ohio. And the in terms of green energy, how does creating the vision for and implementing a sustainable community, the Oberlin Project, how does it lead to jobs that are sustainable as opposed to, like my favorite target, fracking? Go in, drill, create lots of jobs, and then leave. And then there's like seven jobs, or, you know, maybe that might be an exaggeration. But so how does it create long-term, lasting, successful strategies for community?
Let me say a couple of things about that. One thing, that is the acid test, I think.
Eventual
test or failure of any sustainability enterprise. If people can't work, they're not going to be part of the larger sustainability movement. So we've got to create jobs. So, and people will show up in City Hall to fight for these things if their job depends on it. Not because they heard this radio show or heard me say something or read a book somewhere. Right. It's just their livelihood depends on their being, they're working for or with a company that's working in the broad area of sustainability. The second thing I would say is this. If you did an inventory of the amount of stuff that Americans have, which is considerable, probably any given household has 10 or 20,000 things, different things in their home that they own. We've become a very consumptive society. If you took those and said, let's get down to basics, what of this is really critically important? Well, the critically important things are what's in your refrigerator, food, the condition of your house, shelter, the cleanliness and purity of your water, and then your livelihood.
Yes.
And sustainability needs to represent, or must represent eventually, a shift of some substantial part of our workforce, and even kids' labor, into things that really do matter. And when, if hard times do come, and this is not a prediction at all, it's just to say that if hard times do come, it's pretty important to have a local food system that works. And have local farmers, whether it's urban farmers or rooftop gardeners or kind of a standard mixed farm, it's pretty important to have food available. It's pretty important to have clean water. As we found out in the case of Flint and are learning in other cities where lead contamination is a serious issue, it's pretty important to have good housing and have housing that is efficient, clean, green, safe, and so forth. And then it's important to have energy. And the more local your sources of supply for food, energy, water, materials, livelihood, and so forth, the more resilient you are and the more employment you have. One of the great fears I think that many people have, and I certainly share this, is trading off employment to robots. And the trend is that robots will probably take over a good part of American labor. They're already doing it in areas of the automotive industry and manufacturing. But that's not a small issue going ahead.
No, it's
not
a small issue. That is not a small issue. And people are talking about even things like the like Amazon delivering things by droids. I mean, there are so many examples of it that not are coming in the future, but that are already put in place. I mean, people are being replaced by robots in so many ways.
Yeah.
It's really quite terrifying. I hope they don't figure out how to, you know, when you talk about the sustainable jobs, like farmers, local farmers, and all of they do, and local bakeries, and all of these things that are so wonderful and bring such, not just strength and sustainability, but such joy to communities. You know, we're a city of gastronomy in Tucson, the only one in the United States. We're proud of that. I mean, there are so many moving parts for UNESCO to look at, to have us be designated as that city. And the cultural richness is part of it. So, you know, you're not going to believe this, but David, someday, I am so not kidding, we are going to have to do like a 2-hour marathon. We have to take another quick break. And when we come back, I'd really like you to talk a little bit about, I don't know if you can answer this question, but think about it on the break. How do we get more people engaged in the conversation of climate change and all that it means. Because people talk about it, this big pie in the sky, climate change. It is our food. It is our water. It is our housing. It's our safety. It's our food security. So I can't think of anyone I'd love to noodle on that when we come back than David Orr. Everybody, stay here with me.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And today we're asking you to think about climate change and all that it means to each and every one of us, to our families, to the people we love, to our neighbors, our communities. The name of our show today is Scaling Equitable Climate Policy. And it takes me a long time to think of names of shows. And we put a lot of thought into it as a team. And when I have someone like David Orr, who is indeed a Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics, a senior advisor to the president of Oberlin College. He is a man in demand globally for sharing his vision, his thought leadership about how do we, I want to say, you know, stop this big, huge snowball from rolling down the hill and gaining a lot of momentum. And what I want to talk to him about is, David, I want to talk to you about what is the I know so much, and you know that. I eat it, live it, sleep it, read articles about the shape our planet is in as a spokesperson for Mother Earth. What are some of the things that you and I and our listeners can do to continue to raise our voices of concern and to be engaged? It's not just about talking. You know what I mean? So just talk a little bit about that, because you inspire people to change. You get them psyched up about how we can be the change we want to see and get moving on it.
Well, let me, thanks for the question. Let me start and say, start at the very top with, and the most abstract thing that Americans do that has a big part of the larger sustainability transition is your vote. And nobody should ever be able to run for office, whether a city or county or statewide or federal office, without having a coherent, well thought out agenda for sustainability. What does that mean for somebody running for mayor or for city council or for state legislature or for the president of the United States, for that matter? And we have a lot of deniers out there who are denying the science involved in climate change, but they'll, when they need health care, they'll want the very best science they can get.
Right.
And this discrepancy is for politics. But when they feel the chest pain's coming on and they're going to want a really good heart specialist, they're not going to call, you know, 1-800-RUSH. They're going to want somebody who really has serious medical and scientific knowledge of the system they call their body. Well, the same thing applies to the system that we call Earth. So that's one thing. Second thing is getting engaged politically in active forms, whether it's organizing locally as we do in the Oberlin Project or protesting pipelines as done by many organizations in 350.org or fighting battles for community rights as my friend Tom Lindsay has done so well. There are a lot of ways to engage, and this is the time to engage. It takes you back to Henry Thoreau's comment to Ralph Waldo Emerson when Thoreau was in jail, and Emerson asked him, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau's response was, Ralph, what are you doing out there? We need to be engaged, and there's going to be some uncomfortable moments here, but we have good precedents of civil disobedience. There are third things, helping others to get engaged. I think you asked before the break, how do you get people engaged? One way to do this is to begin to build schools that represent the kind of world we want to build, powered by sunshine, light, airy, beautiful places, off gas and no chemical contaminations, with local gardens. My colleagues at the Center for Eco Literacy in Berkeley are doing all over California. They're getting kids involved in growing their food and making their schools carbon neutral and learning the analytic skills of how we build a sustainable world, as well as the moral reasoning behind why we must build that world. And then there's finally the last thing, I put this, some people put this first, but it is to use your buying power as a consumer. If you don't need it, don't buy it. But begin to think more carefully about what it is we buy. What is in that product? Where did it come from? What did it do? What did it do to the people who made it? And beginning to make ourselves much more thoughtful and wiser buyers and also investors. I spent the morning with some investment people that are doing amazingly good work with in changing investments. But how do we realign our money with the way the earth works as a physical system? How do we, in other words, make sure that our money in the economy isn't doing long-term damage to the earth or to people? So there are lots of ways to engage people, and anybody not engaged, I think, is missing an opportunity to, for one thing, do a lot of good. For another thing, probably lower your costs drastically for what you buy and what you do, and live better economically. But also, I'm going to say this, some of the best people, most all of the best people I know, are somehow in this movement, doing various things. There are people like you, and farmers, and city council people, and folks in the legislature, and some in business, and these are the best people I've known. If anybody that needs an example from business, the late Ray Anderson was a model of incredible integrity and brilliance, and he was a very, very good businessman. Interface Carpet was his company, but there are lots more. And I think the point is to be engaged and then to get engaged with other people. Don't be isolated. Don't stay alone by yourself.
And I don't know.
I'm probably going on too long, but there are ways to get involved in this struggle. And let me finally put it this way. This is the struggle of our time.
This is the struggle.
More important, and it is connected to everything else. And if I was to draw connections between various activities, let's take the rise of ISIS that has been such a divisive political issue here and very threatening group and so forth. But if you ask the question, why did ISIS come into existence? That's an ecological question. Why did people in Syria have to leave their farms when there was no rain and so forth? Climate change drove that process, as well as U.S. intervention and so forth. There are lots of reasons here, but to begin to see ecological patterns behind today's headlines. Some are quick problems, but some are just very slow. The color of the water in your local river, if it's brown, there's a slow-moving crisis happening ahead. It's going to be called hunger, and it's going to be called political insecurity and economic collapse. As you're losing topsoil, you're changing ecological possibilities, and those very quickly translate into human realities and political instability and economic ruin.
And David, what you do so well is tie the big, you know, people say climate change and this big, broad, somewhat, you know, for people maybe esoteric, what does that even mean? It's everything. And I wrote that down. This is the struggle for our lifetime, and there isn't any piece of it that doesn't impact all of our lives. Nobody's immune for it. You can't totally run away from it. Even if you can move, you're going to have implications in your life. So to me, it is the issue. It's why I love hearing you speak. It's like why I love the vision that you paint. It's why I love going to Bioneers and living in the Bioneer bubble for 3 days, where it's all about Earth and, you know, the possibilities for change. And one of the things that I am doing more, it's a funny little thing that has gotten me new clients and new engagement in conversation. A simple thing like telling people that Americans consume 500 million straws every day, you would not believe how you can engage people in conversations just around one little factoid like that. It may seem silly, but it's really reflective and symbolic of our lack of consciousness for consumption. Just consume, consume, consume. We throw it away. It doesn't matter. So what if I used 5 or 10 straws today? Where did they come from? How are they transported? What are they made of? And where are they going? It's as simple as that. So that's my little rant. And now back to you, David Orr.
you dismissed the straw as if that was the only thing, but it isn't the only thing.
It's the symbol.
That's right. And there is a huge gyre of trash, probably including lots of straws, floating out in the middle of the Pacific. But there are virtually trash gyres, and some people make them roughly the size of the lower 48 states, and perhaps up to 1,000 feet deep. It's just our plastic junk that floats down rivers and is tossed off boat boats. And most of that is simply unnecessary. Most all of it. We never had to use it in the first place. And straws fit that category. The lip of a glass or the edge of a can is a perfectly useful drinking instrument. You don't have to have a plastic, congealed hydrocarbons to suck fluids out of a glass. But some people make a very good living selling the stuff we really don't need. You know, one of the paradoxes in this, if I have time to say this, is that if you look at the statistics on happiness in this country, my impression is that they peaked in the late 50s. And yet the amount of stuff that we have as Americans in particular keeps rising in the stratosphere. And so that gap between the amount of stuff that we have and the happiness that we experience is a serious indictment. And happiness, generally, as far as I can understand it, is more related to your relationships and friends and work and your poetry and your sports and your hobbies, but the things we do together rather than the things that we have.
Always.
But,
always.
That's maybe the Achilles heel of the growth economy. But
And stopping that. It's like, you know, and you and I have had conversations when we've gotten together about people say to me, you know, you need to narrow your focus. You're all over the place. And I say to them, I have narrowed my focus. It's the planet. And the challenge to me when I go out to some of these conferences and workshops is the whole integration of thought, which the Oberlin Project is reflective of, how many layers there are to it, how many players there are that need to be involved in it. And in order to engage success and have that as your goal, there has to be engagement at so many levels. And it can't be, oh, we're just going to do this or, oh, we're just going to do that. It has to be moving, you know, an entire city or town or group of people in one direction.
Yeah.
Talk about the election a little bit, and feel free. I mean, we have, I think, about like maybe 6 or 8 more minutes left. To me, and I'll just say what I believe, this is one of the most important elections of our time. Who is going to be in the Senate? Who is going to be in the House? I don't have a lot of political conversations on this radio show because, to me, climate change is every man and every woman's issue. So it shouldn't be in the political arena. Every politician should be fighting to get to first place in their solutions for it. How important is it for people to understand that their vote will matter, that it will impact our climate policies, the agreements we make with our, you know, big ag people and the methane issues? I mean, it goes on and on. What do you want to say? Give us a little bit of sage advice about what questions we should be asking of our elected officials or our, you know, the candidates running.
Well, that's a great topic, a really necessary topic. Of course, presidential year and American politics are in incredible disarray. And
I've never seen anything like it.
I haven't either. Let me just say this: as far as I'm not going to endorse a candidate, I think my politics will be pretty clear. But it is appalling to see the following items. One is the amount of money that flows into this kind of open sewer of unaccounted, unaccountable, and untransparent money. And the Supreme Court opened that floodgate to corruption so that people, very wealthy people, can simply buy their democracy and buy your corrupt democracy and buy the government. That is an outrage. And the Supreme Court should be taken out behind the woodshed, and every one of the members that voted for it spanked or whatever.
That's a good visual.
The second thing is, that was simply an unconscionable decision. You'd have to go back to, there have been several recent awful Supreme Court decisions, but the Dred Scott decision of the Taney Court was always thought to be the worst decision ever. But I think, in fact, the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court would certainly rival it. And with some implications that are very similar in some way, that it takes some explaining. I don't have time to get into, but that's one thing. The second thing is the amount of ignorance on the part of the roughly 20 people, if I add up correctly, that are running or began to run the race for the White House.
Right.
And only a couple of them had any awareness that climate change was an issue. And I don't mean to be partisan here, but none of the Republicans got
right.
it. And a few would mumble a few words from time to time about, yeah, it's real, but they didn't want to do anything about it. That was like Chris Christie. But that was appalling. It's like in 1850, somebody running for federal office in the United States who didn't understand slavery as an issue.
Right.
And this is a much bigger issue than slavery. You could manumit slaves with enough vision and foresight and compassion, but you cannot manumit the effects of climate change. Once you put carbon in the atmosphere, you're condemning people for a very long time to suffer the consequences of your profligacy.
Right.
And so that omission, if I change the historical analogy, it'd be maybe like people in Britain in 1938 not wanting to come to grips with Adolf Hitler and not listening to Winston Churchill when Churchill told them that you better pay attention to events in Central Europe, and if you don't, there will be the hell to pay. And
right.
they didn't, and of course there was. We call it World War II. So those two things stand out, and they're of course related. Money has bought a lot of politicians, and they're dependent on it. The upshot is, if we really want to improve American politics, I think that we ought to have federally financed elections, period. We pay for them one way or another. Let's pay for them above the table. And so nobody could take private contributions. The Supreme Court believes otherwise, as they've argued in a previous case, that the spending of money in a campaign is free speech. But that means that the Koch brothers with $42 billion and poor people with a net worth of nearly zero have hugely different votes to cast. The Koch brothers have a very big megaphone, and they can influence millions of votes. But somebody with no money or very little money and few assets can't do that. You have one vote to cast, and that's it. So this is overall the corruption of democracy, and it's manifest. There isn't really much debate about it that's worth having. What we do about it, however, is worthy of debate. And I applaud, in this case, Bernie Sanders and also Secretary Clinton. I mean, both of them, in their different ways, have addressed this issue. But no Republican could do it. And I think, and this is not an argument for Democrats over Republicans necessarily, but it is to say that this is a kind of dereliction that is inexcusable in American politics or in any Democratic politics.
And the irony to me, and I don't know if the irony is the right word, the sadness, I can't think of enough words, is that it doesn't really matter if they're for it, against it, whatever. It's happening. So the sadness is, please, let's just acknowledge that we are in the most serious journey of our life, the most critical days to come for ourselves and our children, and the politicians are just sadly acting like it's not going to impact business. It's not going to impact our taxes. I mean, come on, folks. Let's wake up and get on board. David Orr,
yep.
I think the world of you. Give my love to your wife, and I hope I see you at Bioneers.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing an hour with me. I really appreciate it. Good to hear your voice.
I appreciate you. Everybody be with us next week. Stuff on Tucson Water and Nina Simons from Bioneers will be my guest on the June 4th show. Make it a great green week. David, thanks for showing up in my life.
Peter, thank you so much.